I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Where do you get your information about the presidential campaign? Public radio, commercial radio, cable TV, the national networks, local TV news, Twitter, your hometown paper or national newspaper, email from friends and family? Well, today in Radio Times, we want to take a critical look at the media coverage of the presidential race, how traditional and digital journalism report the news, the appeal and pitfalls of horse race journalism, the rise of polls, the role of fact checkers, and much, much more. We have two guests who have joined us. Garance Frankie Ruda is senior editor at The Atlantic, where she oversees the Politics Channel. She was previously national web politics editor at The Washington Post, also worked at The American Prospect, The Washington City Paper, The New Republic, and National Journal magazines. And Garance Frankie Ruda, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me on today.
You're welcome. Also with us is Walter Shapiro, veteran journalist covering his ninth presidential campaign. He's a columnist for Yahoo News, also writes for the Columbia Journalism Review. Previously, he worked for USA Today and The Washington Post, Time and Newsweek, Esquire and The Washington Monthly, and Salon and Slate. And Walter Shapiro, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
I'm exhausted.
I am too. I'm exhausted and I'm impressed. And let me begin with you, if I could, Walter Shapiro, because you are a veteran journalist who is covering his ninth presidential.
Oh, the Coolidge campaign was great fun.
Well, let's just go back a couple of campaigns. How would you compare this presidential election to past ones when it comes to mendacity, nastiness, intensity?
Intensity of spin high, intensity of TV ads, which are probably self-defeating in their overkill high, intensity of enthusiasm for candidates lower than most campaigns I can remember. Mendacity, I just think having been through the Willie Horton ads of 1988, maybe my standards for a record-setting campaign in mendacity are a little too high to be realistic. What I think this really is what's distinctive about this campaign is that both the vast amounts of money rolling around, or actually trying to come up with an aquatic metaphor, and I failed.
Rolling is okay.
Washing over the swing states, the smallness of the political map, that the fact is that we've been really, with the exception of Wisconsin, which has popped up in the last month or so, we have pretty much been arguing over the last seven or eight states since the springtime, which is pretty unprecedented. And I guess the other thing that is distinctive is that we probably have the two candidates who have the lowest belief in candor in American history. Just that these are candidates who are so controlled, so within themselves, that anything, even the smallest whiff of spontaneity, is as big a discovery as the kind you make in a stream by Sutter's Mill in California in 1848.
Wow. Well, I do want to pick up on that, but Garance, let me get you in on the conversation. What kind of challenge, then, does the press have covering the kind of race that Walter Shapiro just described?
Well, I think the challenges have to do with both the candidates and campaign and also the changes in media that we have now and the media environment. Because of the internet, and you know, this is a disruption that's been going on for a long time, a transformation that's been going on for quite some time now. I think it's harder for the kind of traditional campaign trail coverage to break through, and so you see a lot more sort of Instagram coverage, small blog items, a lot of tweets. I think one of the biggest transformations in media this cycle has been the way that Twitter has really become the homepage for political journalists. And for the political class more generally, there's this sort of ongoing networked conversation among insiders all day and all night long, you know, with everything happening at light speed. And so I think the challenge there is that figuring a way to say things that are new and really get to something unique and interesting about the candidate and the candidate's policies, especially because both of these candidates have been very loath to be clear about what they would like to do as president. Obama, you know, just released his booklet rounding up his proposals for the second term, and Romney has, I think, said a number of directions that he would outlined a number of directions in which he'd like to go, but has been loath to get into specifics. It's sort of part of his character's desire not to get into specifics, to give himself the flexibility when a situation presents itself to sort of evaluate it at that moment.
Let me pick up on something that you said, because I know that you have said this before, but I want to make sure the listeners understand that the last election cycle was all about blogs. I mean, the blogs were that shiny new toy that people were using to talk about the campaigns, and now it's Twitter, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Meaning that Twitter speeds things up.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's and it also shrinks things down even more than blogging, you know. And it's sort of, and there's a lot of comic wit on Twitter as well. You know, it's I suppose not very surprising. But I think in some ways Twitter is if you follow the right people, if you follow reporters, you know reporters tend to stand around in the back of the room anyway, cracking jokes amongst each other while they're
exactly.
watching something.
Right.
Now that's a conversation that's transparent to the world. I don't know if that improves journalism or not, but it's happening.
Indeed it is. Well, Walter Shapiro, just picking up on that, and one thing that I was reading, and these are not my words, that the 24-hour news cycle has been replaced by the 140-character cycle. Good for journalism, bad for journalism, good for the public, bad for the public?
I am a fan, Walter Shapiro at PD, Walter Shapiro PD, a Twitter handle. I'm a big fan of Twitter, and I'm a big fan of Twitter for two reasons. Number one, you can decide who you want to follow, and those people who overshare about their lunch, you can quickly unfollow. But much more importantly, what Twitter really is, beyond the wisecracks, is a curated look at how the campaign is unfolding, with links to very smart articles I would never have seen otherwise. In a world where I was worried 2-3 years ago that we would be part of the dumbing down of journalism and everything else to write headlines and stories to appeal to basically Google search engines, writing headlines like "What time is the Super Bowl?" and mentioning names like J-Lo in the lead of every political story to get enough hits. Compared to that awful direction that we seem to be going in 2008, 2009, the rise of Twitter, which is basically a curated news feed from smart people, is such a salutary development.
But picking up on that, and as you say, Walter Shapiro, and you, Garance Frankie Ruta, which is that a lot of journalists are doing this, but are they always smart people, Walter Shapiro?
Of course not. No more than the jokes at the back of a campaign rally in 2004 whispered were always the kind of epic humor that would live the way a Marx Brothers movie would live. But at the same point, while that it is a smart way to get the news, mm-hmm. I probably 50% of what I read on the web, other than trips to certain websites like the New York Times, the Atlantic, the New Republic, is really links through Twitter. And I think, yes, of course, the attention span is unbelievably short. But the attention span would have been unbelievably short in this campaign, even if we were still chiseling out copy with stone chisels in hieroglyphics, that somebody would have figured out how to bring the 24-hour news cycle to Babylon.
Picking up on that, Garance, but has Twitter also opened the digital universe up to non-so-called elite pundits? I mean, people that aren't part of the Washington Beltway crowd, and given them a chance to talk about politics?
Yeah, absolutely. And I should say my Twitter handle is TheGarance, that I picked up when I had a blog of that name many years ago, because if you put the word "the" in front of most things, they're available as URLs.
Oh, good to know.
Yes. You know, I think it is also, you know, for someone like me, I follow a lot of people on Twitter, and it's a way to get information from state reporters. And it gives them a greater visibility to the National Press Corps, and you know, so it's a nice way to keep a handle on regional media as well. There are some people who, by force of personality, have become, you know, sort of major figures on Twitter, you know, Pour Me Coffee and so on, who is a bit of a political comic. And, you know, people communicate with each other back and forth all the time. If somebody who's just a sort of a reader asks a question, many people will respond if it's a smart question, and so then suddenly you're able to have this sort of transparent conversation with a political figure or a media figure if you're just sort of an average reader. but I think I also am a huge fan of Twitter and, you know, its ability to sort of expand the campaign conversation.
So two thumbs up for Twitter. Let me ask you, Walter Shapiro, and it seems that every day, maybe every hour, there seems to be a new poll that has, you know, come out talking about this presidential race. Is that helpful for us that are trying to figure out issues and who we might want to vote for?
I think at a certain level, it is not helpful. For example, at this point, there is a point, I was thought it was particularly not helpful when we were having breathless coverage of polls back in June, July, early September. Of course, right now, what almost everyone wants to know is what is unknowable, which is who is going to win.
Right.
I think the real problem right now is that too many media organizations which write their polling contracts many months in advance are too committed to national polls, where in truth, the only thing I follow, and I've been actually got this advice from a major national pollster who also does state polls, who basically said, I can't say this publicly because I have a contract, but ignore the national polls because we don't care about the enthusiasm level of Republicans in Texas or Democrats in California. We know what's happening with those states. And my experience, I have recently been in Iowa and Ohio, and I'm leaving this afternoon for Colorado, is that the intensity of the campaign that voters experience, not only with TV ads, but in contacts with volunteers coming to their doors in the swing states, is so qualitatively different than the experience in the other states that I really find that the reactions of national voters, they're not reacting to the same stimuli as state voters.
Well, that's interesting. Let's take a very short break, and we'll get back to our conversation. And, Garance, I want to get you in on this whole question about the roles of polls when it comes to election coverage. And we are talking about how we are getting our news, how we are disseminating our news, talking with Walter Shapiro. He's a columnist for Yahoo News, also writes for Columbia Journalism Review. Garance Frankiruta is senior editor at The Atlantic, where she oversees the Politics Channel. And this is a show for you because we want to know where and how and when you're getting your news. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Are you or is someone you know overweight? Drexel University is currently enrolling overweight participants in Mind Your Health, a research study evaluating methods of losing weight and keeping it off without medication. These programs are funded by the National Institutes of Health. More information online at drexel.edu/weightloss or 215-762-4900. That's 215-762-4900. Drexel supports WHYY.
7.45 miles. That's how long the course is for the 4th annual Y12K road race. Think you can handle it? Don't worry. There's also a relaxing 3K family walk run and the Y Kids Family Fit Zone. Sign up and hit the streets to support WHYY Saturday, November 10th. Runner or beginner, it's healthy fun for a good cause. Everyone's welcome. The course takes you from the Art Museum to Falls Bridge and back again. Visit whyy.org/Y12K.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Chamber music masterworks from Mozart, Dvorak, and Brahms performed by members of the Philadelphia Orchestra with guest Cynthia Rehm, who will perform Brahms' first piano quartet, Dvorak's string quartet, also Mozart's duo for violin and viola. Tickets at 215-893-1999 and online. This Sunday afternoon at 3 in the Perlman Theater at the Kimmel Center, Mozart, Dvorak, and Brahms with members of the Philadelphia Orchestra.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and I know you hang on my every word when it comes to election coverage, but we want to know where else you are getting your coverage and how you would rate that coverage as we bear down on Election Day, looking at the media coverage of the presidential race. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Also, the Radio Times Twitter handle is WHYY Radio Times. Talking with Garanz, Frankie Ruda, and Walter Shapiro. And again, we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Garanz, going back to you and picking up on this whole issue of polls, do you think, though, that the press, the media relies just much too much on polls, and that by responding to all these polls that seem to be coming out every day now, you end up getting a kind of horse race coverage of the campaign as opposed to a more substantive issue coverage of the campaign?
I think it's not so much a question of the horse race versus the issues, but rather the view from, 30,000 feet versus the view on the ground. The polls are useful. I think to some extent people may be influenced by the polls. People want to back a winner, and people, there's so many polls right now that are out, many of them not particularly with great reliable histories and track records that people can point to defend whatever particular view they would like to believe. There's been a lot of attacking the polls this year, and some of that is for reasons that are partisan, and some of it is for reasons that are in fact legitimate methodological questions. For example, now that there's so many people on cell phones, I haven't had a landline since 2006. How are these people being included in the polls? Are the results different when you include them now that that population is so substantial? What if you're only doing polls in English? How does that impact your polling in states where there's a large, primarily Spanish-speaking population? And you see that particularly in a state like Nevada, where I think there's an understanding that the polls are not including Spanish speakers are not going to be accurately completely reflecting the race. And you saw that with Harry Reid's race as well in the past.
In Nevada. That's
yeah.
Walter Shapiro, going back to you and even picking up on this horse race critique of the media coverage, but I'm thinking about the four debates that we just had, and it seemed that within a minute or even less after those debates were over, if you were watching cable television, the first question was, who won, who lost? Is that a helpful question?
No, actually, obviously it was a helpful question in terms of understanding the devastating effect of the first debate on Barack Obama. But in general, no, because first of all, this is not an hour-by-hour presidential campaign. And having talked to undecided voters, they get pushed in directions based on little factors. Maybe they will watch the debate. Maybe they will watch 7 minutes of news coverage while they're having breakfast the following morning. Maybe they'll look at a headline in a newspaper. So the idea of who won, who lost, as if that this will determine how the debate percolates through the political system is wrong. Also, the most unreliable things around are the instant polls after debates for a very simple reason. Debates are over at 10:30 at night. You're not exactly going to be a very popular pollster if you are calling people in the Eastern time zone between, say, 11 and midnight, or given how early they go to bed in Iowa, in the central time zone during the same period. So these polls, and this is something that's been true for 30 years and no one will point it out, are almost exclusively of people in the Pacific and central and the mountain time zones. And the real problem is, if you look at the map, with the exception of Colorado and Nevada, there are no swing states in those time zones.
You mentioned the undecided voters, and much has been made about them, Walter Shapiro, and I do want to get you, Garanz, Frankie Ruda, in on this as well. And they've been described in many ways. Some people say they're, low-information voters, or they don't care about elections. How do you see who these undecided voters are, Walter?
Well, I did a column on this for the Columbia Journalism Review, and I did reporting on this, building on reporting on this I did for Yahoo News in Iowa. And the truth is that they are often, while they may not be news junkies, they are often people who are conflicted. Like my emblematic Iowa undecided voter is a 39-year-old police officer in Newton, Iowa, who served two tours of duty in Iraq with the Marines, who is liberal on social issues and voted for Obama as that reason in 2008, but has been disappointed and was trying to weigh the conservatism of Romney's position, say, on gays, with his lack of enthusiasm for the Obama economic record. I don't consider him a low-information voter. I consider him a tormented voter. And there is no reason in the Constitution, I've read this many times, that voters have to make up their mind until Election Day. This is an anathema to the press. It is also an anathema to the campaigns in states like Iowa and Ohio that have early voting, that are making so much of a premium on early voting, as if you are somehow deficient in your civic duty if you wait till Election Day to make up your minds. So, for the most part, I think undecided voters or loosely aligned voters get a bad rap.
And you see them as tormented. Garance, how do you see these undecided voters?
Well, I think the more important voters this cycle are what they call the sporadic voters rather than the undecideds, because there are very few undecideds at this time. The country is pretty much dug in terms of the partisan divide, and I think a lot of people know their minds already. There's a small sliver of people who may find their values and their interests in conflict, and I like Walter's phrase, tormented voters, but it's the sporadic voters who will probably be the ones making the difference. Obama was able to win because he changed the electorate in 2008. In 2010, the electorate was, much whiter and much older than it had been in 2008. Whether Obama wins re-election is going to depend largely on who comprises the electorate. And who is comprising it, since early voting began, since absentee voting began, and on voting on Election Day, which is no longer, an election day, but rather the day the election ends.
Walter, you wrote a piece about the debates. I don't know if you were exactly admonishing the press, but you were suggesting watch the debates or listen to the debates like a voter would. And by that, you mean just paying attention, turn off your Twitter, stop blogging, and just listen to what the candidates say.
That was my dream, unfortunately, I was also part of a live blog for Yahoo, and a couple of times I thought my comments on the live blog were so epic that I thought they might get their 3 seconds of fame on Twitter. So it may have been one of the great moments of hypocrisy of my career, but I'm not trying to be too hard on myself. But what I am trying to say, because the point of the CJR piece, the Columbia Journalism Review piece, was if you don't watch the debate the way an ordinary voter would, don't presume to be able to divine what the political ramifications of the debate were. And I have pretty much followed that by basically cautioning against any glib interpretations of the political effects of debates based on what you, a high-information reporter, or you, a high-information voter, took away from it.
There have been, though, to use Walter Shapiro's words, epic tweets, Garance, coming from the debates, whether it has to do with, binders full of women that took off in the Twitter sphere and certainly was the big story in the mainstream media, the sort of daily news the next day.
This is what people are calling the first meme election. The idea of these sort of small online visuals or phrases that get turned into visuals that have taken off. Binders full of women was one coming out of what Romney was saying about how he approached hiring as a new Massachusetts governor. There have been many other ones. Horses and bayonets, for example, coming out of the last debate. You know, there was, you know, a whole second day story there where people were pushing back and saying, you know, hey, the United States Marines and the Army still use bayonets, and here's who makes them, and here's how many we have. And, you know, there was a horse brigade that went into Afghanistan in 2001, and, you know, we still use horses. And, you know, you learn these sort of interesting things, but does any of this have anything to do with what people are going to vote on? Absolutely not. No, it's kind of entertainment. It's political entertainment.
And there's nothing wrong with that, is there, Garant?
No, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, the binders for the woman, I think, had slightly more meaning because, you know, there is a huge fight right now for the women's vote. Obama cannot win unless he has as big a gender gap as he did last time. And, you know, Romney needs to close that and keep it closed.
Well, we are talking about the media coverage, the press coverage of the presidential race, talking with Garant's Frankie Ruda, senior editor at The Atlantic, where she oversees the Politics Channel. Also with us is Walter Shapiro. He's a journalist covering his ninth presidential campaign, a columnist for Yahoo News, also writes for the Columbia Journalism Review. And again, we want to hear from you about where and how you are getting your political coverage. Perhaps you're on a diet because of all the coverage over the last couple of years, and a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Also, another question to you, which is that are there issues, even candidates that are not getting the kind of coverage that you think they deserve? Give us a call on that as well. Let's see what Willie from South Philadelphia has to say. And Willie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi.
Hi there.
So I'm not on a diet of political news, for sure. I'm on a gluttony of political news. I get it mostly from Politico and NPR. But I've been frustrated with most of it being he said, she said type news. And a specific example is in California, there's a story on Politico about Republican Jeff Dunham, who's going to sue the DCCC about an ad that says he was going to vote to cut pay for veterans. Nowhere in this article does it say whether or not he voted to cut pay for veterans.
And you're frustrated.
I'm frustrated that they don't go ahead and include. It would take, you know, one line or two lines about that, and they don't even bother.
Well, Willie, let me see what Garant's Frankie Ruda has to say. And Walter Shapiro, thanks for calling into Radio Times. He said, she said journalism, Garant's?
Well, this has also been an election where, you know, the fact-checkers have never been more important. You know, we have candidates who are willing to stretch the truth sometimes rather dramatically in television advertisements. And it's been a real struggle, I think, for journalists to figure out a way to get that kind of fact-checking into every story without seeming like they're taking a position for or against a candidate. But, you know, this has absolutely been the fact-check election.
But are you concerned that and there are fact-checking organizations, and it's their job to fact-check what people are saying or candidates are saying. Are you concerned, Garant, that has been sort of given over to, that's their responsibility and the press doesn't see it as their responsibility?
Well, I think actually the press does see it as their responsibility, and most major media outlets also have fact-checking operations on hand. I mean, it's not just been outsourced to, you know, factcheck.org or something. You know, everybody is, you know, fact-checking debates in real time when they happen. The issue is that, you know, on online journalism where people are encountering links and stories by themselves, you know, something may have been thoroughly discussed in a fact-checking column on a website of, say, the New York Times or the Washington Post, but you can't put all that information into, you know, the Daily Brief story, right? And so it's when treating the information more glancingly that, you know, or just, you know, really rapidly writing down what someone has said that this sort of stuff sort of fades away.
Walter, I mean, what does the press or what should the press do about either lies or misrepresentations?
Well, it's a difficult question. I have finally reluctantly, for extreme cases, like for example, claims that Barack Obama was born in Kenya or one that sort of thing. I think very clearly the press should use distinct words like lie to make it very clear that this is not a matter of interpretation or some say and some respond. Where you get murky is in areas like Mitt Romney's economic numbers do not add up by any stretch of the imagination. I believe in the second debate he said that the rich will not pay any less of their share of the income, nor any more, and the middle class will get a tax cut. And it will be revenue neutral. If the middle class gets a tax cut and the rich pay the same share of national income, where does the money come from? It's very hard to call that a lie, a misrepresentation, a vagueness, an arithmetical something or other. And that those are the murky issues that we really get into. And I don't have an easy answer for this, but going back to what the caller started with, the he said, she responded sort of journalism, one of the problems of this crazed news cycle that we're all on is that many people are being forced to write 5, 6, 7 pieces a day. And it's really hard to have any sense of nuance or depth of research when you're writing quickie pieces in 20, 30 minutes. As a result, it's a lot safer to say he said, he responded.
But just picking up on the example that you use, Walter, which is to say that the numbers don't add up, it seems to me that, and I've read this and certainly heard this, that you can quote, you know, the CBO, or you can quote organizations whose job it is to look at these numbers, and it seems to me that's not taking sides, that's just trying to be factual.
Oh, and I don't have problems with that, but I also, for many things said on the campaign trail, such as the Romney, since the CBO, for example, the Congressional Budget Office, only deals with specific pieces of legislation, it isn't like the Congressional Budget Office has weighed in on the Romney economic plan as described by Romney in real time during the second debate.
About a minute and a half before our second debate, our second break, but let me ask you a question about the debates, Garance, and we had four of them, four different formats, four different moderators. Was there one you think that was better than the other in terms of getting closer to real issues?
Well, I actually thought that all the debates handled real issues. If you're asking about, to evaluate the moderators, I think, most people would agree that the latter three were more deftly moderated, because slightly more aggressively moderated.
Which is a good thing, right? To be
absolutely. I thought Martha Raddatz asked great questions. I thought Candy Crowley did a really great job, with a very aggressive Mitt Romney, who was, continually trying to sort of knock her off course a little bit. And I thought Bob Schieffer also did a really subtle job, a little bit more pulled back.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about the press, the media coverage of the presidential campaign this year, talking with Garance Franchi-Ruta, the voice you just heard, senior editor at The Atlantic, oversees the Politics Channel. Also with us is Walter Shapiro. He's now covering his 9th presidential campaign, a columnist for Yahoo News, also writes for the Columbia Journalism Review. And we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. How would you rate the coverage? Give us a call. We'll be right back.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. As part of a citywide celebration of Frank Furness on the anniversary of his death, PAFA is exhibiting architectural drawings of the Furness-designed historic landmark building. On view through December 30th, these rare drawings document the evolution of this historical building. More information online at pafa.org or by phone at 215-972-7600.
Sure, shouting angry pundits can be entertaining, but when they run out of breath, ask yourself this. Did you actually learn something new, or just get the same old spin? Trust Election 2012 on WHYY for the real story, not the spin. Each day, our team of journalists is out there finding the stories that showcase every perspective, not just one slanted side. WHYY-FM, newsworks.org, and WHYY-TV, where you go to know.
Longwood Gardens supports WHYY. Longwood Gardens and the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society present a lecture and book signing with international landscape architect Kim Wilkie on October 29th at WHYY in Philadelphia. Wilkie's the author of a new book, Led by the Land, where he discusses landscape, sustainability, regeneration, and design. Wilkie's also the designer of Longwood Gardens East Conservatory Plaza, home to the largest green wall in North America. Tickets and details at longwoodgardens.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Motz-Cohen. With less than 2 weeks to Election Day, how well have the media done covering the candidates, the races, the debates, the issues? We have a full bank of calls. Let's get back to our callers. We have Jessica from Collegeville joining us. And Jessica, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
My comment is about the general perception of how the candidates were performing in the debates. And I feel like in the very first debate, Mitt Romney was so aggressive, interruptions, you know, the whole nine yards. And everybody said, you know, Obama lost. And I don't know that that was because of what he said, but how he acted. And then come the second debate, I believe it sort of turned into a spectacle. And I was embarrassed that that's how it turned into. You know, it was constant interruptions. They were talking over each other. And everybody was like, wow, it was great. You know, Obama came back. And quite frankly, I was embarrassed that, you know, he was almost forced to act that way in order for him to gain some, you know, respect saying that he won. I believe that in the first debate, he acted like the president of the United States. Then in the second debate, he had to kind of give the American public what they wanted, which was a spectacle, which was a dramatic performance. And I was very upset that that's what the debates kind of turned into. You know, the third debate, they were more reserved, and I think that they sort of pulled back. But generally, I was very disappointed that that's what it had to be for him to sort of get some respect. You were talking about, you know, who won, who lost, and it makes me really wonder, well, why did they say he lost? Was it because of what he said or because of how he acted? And, you know, just quite frankly,
sure,
I was embarrassed if that's what the American public needed.
I hear you, and I appreciate the call. Let me toss that to you, Walter Shapiro.
Well, I have been watching debates for quite a while, and I think that Barack Obama in the first debate, with the exception of Dan Quayle and Sarah Palin, may have been the worst performance by any debater, president for vice president, I've ever seen. And it was not only a performance. There was no clear argument. This was not a media perception. It was also something that was ratified by voters by, I think, the largest who won, who lost answer in the Gallup poll in history. And it was also reflected in a significant drop in Obama's lead in state polls. I was talking to, before the first debate, I was talking to Ohio Republicans on deep background who were speculating about would Romney have to pull out of the state. That clearly didn't happen. So it is not as if the Obama was masterful and the media somehow didn't recognize his innate greatness about the first debate. It was, for whatever reason, a totally deficient performance and argument. Because if we're going to, both sides agreed to these formats, and if you're going to have a debate, it should be a clash of ideas, not extracts from your campaign speeches.
Jessica, let me see what Garance has to say. And I hear Jessica's struggle with the style versus substance argument. Your thoughts?
Well, I mean, I think there is this sort of question, you know, are debates the best way to evaluate what the candidates are offering? It is the first opportunity people had to see the two of them side by side, to see Romney and Obama side by side. And I think, you know, what the Republicans have been saying is that Obama spent months, you know, from May through September building up this caricature of who Mitt Romney was, and then he came out there and he wasn't that caricature. He was, you know, I mean, Mitt Romney's a lot more personable than people give him credit for being. And so it wasn't just, you know, how Obama performed and the argument he made or didn't make on his own behalf, but also that it was the national audience's maybe first opportunity to see Mitt Romney speaking at length. And he didn't look as scary and as conservative to them as he had appeared in the advertising to that time. And I think that, you know, really impacted things as well.
Let me get John from Germantown to join us. John, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, good morning,
good morning.
Marty. I am calling with regards to Gia Foreman coverage of and vetting of the president. I believe that the media is extremely biased and in favor of the Democrats, and I think that has become apparent through these debates. Let me give you two specific examples.
Well, John, if you don't mind, just give us one, only because we've got a lot of callers, but go ahead.
No problem. No mention of Libya and foreign policy debate. I mean, that should have been the opening question, especially based on what Candy Crowley misrepresented the transcript in the second debate, and not one mention of that. And then still, to this day, there has been no coverage of Libya, and actually what has happened, even though so much more information has been released.
Well, John, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And let me just say, only because we did a show about Libya yesterday, that at the foreign policy debate, that was the first question, but neither of the candidates, I would say, adequately answered it. But Walter Shapiro, do you think there is a media bias in favor of the Democrats?
No, I think there is a media bias in favor of drama. I think there is a media bias to build up whoever is behind and tear down who's ever ahead. It is part of our DNA. Unfortunately, we are, as the late New York Times columnist Bill Sapphire put it, we are a culture built around, journalists are a culture around, kick them when they're up.
Kick them when they're up.
Go
ahead, Garant.
I would say that I'm not quite sure that I agree with that. I think there's more of a bias toward whoever appears to have power. And it shouldn't be that way, but I do think, having lived in Washington and been a journalist here for 15 years now, that I'm fairly comfortable making a statement that journalism tends to be attracted to power. And that's one of the reasons you see so much reporting on, you know, what strategists have to say, what pollsters have to say, what, you know, officials who may have nothing to do with the race but who are important personages have to say, and less reporting this cycle than perhaps any other, on what the American people have to say and what people in non-swing states have to say. You know, God forbid we should actually talk to, you know, people whose
votes, actual people.
To people whose votes are not going to swing a state. You know, I think if you talk to people about their lives and what's going on, I mean, and just, we have a lot of reporting about what important personages say and much less about what's happening in the country.
I mean, do you think that the press has too close a relation, maybe we're talking about the Beltway press, too close a relationship with the people that they cover?
Sometimes the relationships get a little borderline, I think. You know, people are on the trail a long time, but, you know, if there's an opportunity to make news by saying something that's potentially damaging to somebody, I don't know a single reporter who won't take that opportunity. But I think the bigger issue is just the sort of general bias towards, oh, let's, you know, get quotes from important people, and, you know, and we forget about the quote unimportant people who are, you know, the people who are actually deciding this thing.
Walter Shapiro, let me ask you, why would a self-respecting journalist venture into a room that calls itself the spin room, you know, after a debate? I have never understood that.
Well, first of all, I just want to say that I agree with what Grant said, and that there is a sycophancy towards power that is particularly true in Washington, and there's also a cult of the campaign consultant. It's interesting that the first cult of the campaign book, Making of the President in 1960, half of it was about demographic changes in America. Huh. Going back to your spin room question, the only point for going into a spin room is for taking people aside, going off the record, and asking the one question every reporter who is not a TV host always asks: why haven't you returned my phone calls?
Truly?
Yes. And that is just getting people in the spin room, being able to take them aside. You're not going to find out anything about the debate, but you can remind them that you exist and ask them, why haven't you returned my phone calls? That said, I have stopped going to debates during the general elections a long time ago because quite frankly, traveling somewhere to watch something on television does seem a little weird.
It does seem a little weird. Just a quick question to you, Garance, because I noticed before even these debates, the pundits were saying, oh, the public doesn't care, they're not going to tune in. And then we find out that 50, 60, even more millions of people tuned into the debates. Is that another example of the press kind of trashing voters and the public?
Well, I think people didn't care during the primaries as much. I mean, there was, I think, an effort during the Republican primary out of fairness and out of a desire, you know, to keep the story going in a way, to suggest that there was more drama and more tension in the contest than there appeared to be. I don't think it was realistic for anyone to think that Newt Gingrich had a shot of winning the Republican presidential nomination. But, you know, for a while, people had to, you know, act like that was a possibility. And I think public interest was based on a realistic assessment of the situation, which was that there was very little drama in that contest after, you know, after Iowa and New Hampshire. And so the public kind of tuned out. And then people came back online once, you know, the conventions happened. There's huge interest now in the story.
Let me get Richard from Lower Gwynedd to join us. And go ahead, Richard, you're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi.
I am blind, so I listen to the debates. And my impression is that most of the commentators are basing on their analysis on what they're seeing and what they want to hear.
Richard, I'm curious. So what were you listening to? I'm just curious.
I actually flip between the different channels.
So CNN or Fox or MSNBC or ABC, PBS, all of that?
All that, yes.
All that. And that's the impression that you got, that it was more about what it looked like than what it sounded like?
Right, yes. Well, and their sound bites at least suggest to me that they really picked the sound bites that they wanted to hear, and some of them are out of context.
Well, Richard, let me see what Walter Shapiro has to say. Walter, your thoughts.
Well, sound bites are biased towards dramatic exchanges, and that is why substance often doesn't make the highlights reels. That said, for my columns for Yahoo, I have gone through the, all the debate transcripts slowly the morning after, looking for revelations about how Obama would govern in his second term or Romney would govern, and they are few and far between. That if you look at the debates purely for substance, you have to spend an awful lot of time looking.
Richard, thanks for calling into Radio Times to see what Lewis from Vineland, New Jersey has to say. Lewis, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. I'd like to ask the question as far as bias goes. We have Donald Trump get on the TV to make outlandish comments and running with the birther thing still, but yet we have journalists falling over themselves yet still to try and hear what Donald Trump has to say when it's almost been reported that Donald Trump is really an advocate for Romney and just basically stirring up trouble.
Well, Lewis, let me see what Garance Frankie Ruda has to say. Garance?
Well, you know, I think that's part of the political entertainment portion of the reporting. You know, people recognize that Donald Trump is
what?
He's
what is he, Garance?
He's basically just getting attention for himself. You know, he's getting attention for himself. He's doing what's good for Donald, and for the Donald. But he is a Romney surrogate. Romney, you know, accepted his endorsement on a stage, he has a lot of resources he could devote to finding something out if he wanted to. I mean, I don't think he really wants to, but.
But Walter, do you think that the press then are kind of enablers when it comes to interviewing someone like a Donald Trump?
Well, my policy on Donald Trump is very simple. The only way to give him the respect he deserves is to totally ignore him. Even denouncing him plays into it. So I have decided that for the rest of my life, I am a Donald Trump free zone.
And I'm sorry I asked you that question because you just broke your own rule there.
Only for you.
But I was reading in preparation for this show that where most people get their information about presidential campaigns is through their local TV news outlet. Walter Shapiro, is that probably pretty true?
Well, I believe that's based on Pew numbers, and I actually sat in a hotel room in Des Moines watching local news for a day, just trying to figure out what they were seeing, what voters were seeing. And I hate to break it to you, local news is even worse than you imagined. As far the top three stories in Des Moines on a particular day were all about different sexual predators. And something tells me that Des Moines, Iowa, is not the sexual predator capital of America. So I feel sorry for anyone who looks to local TV news as their primary source of political information.
And Garanza, do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, since for 2 years now, we've known that the majority of people get their news online rather than through television or through other types of media. And, you know, it may be that they're getting it from, you know, CNN online or ABC online rather than from ABC on television. So it's the same company, just a different medium. But, you know, and I think that does make a difference because, you know, It's text, and it's not just political entertainment, although there's a certain amount of that.
Walter Shapiro, we're almost out of time, but again, using your advantage as a veteran journalist, as we've been calling you, does it make any sense to follow the candidates around over the next week and a half as they, you know, crisscross the country?
Very quickly, anytime candidates who are not in public that often say anything, particularly in the last 2 weeks of the campaign, it is important. The thing I would not spend time doing is breathlessly reporting what aides think, because we are now at the point where anything an aide to either candidate says is total disinformation.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Walter Shapiro, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
And Garanza Frankie Ruta, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. She's a senior editor at The Atlantic. She oversees the Politics Channel. Walter Shapiro is covering his ninth presidential campaign. He's a columnist for Yahoo News, also writes for Columbia Journalism Review. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program, including Twitter and Facebook. We have a very lively social media there that I invite you to check out. I'm Marty Moscowane. Stay with us for the second hour of Radio Times.